Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Tired of restless nights? At Lisa, we know good sleep is essential for mental, physical, and emotional health. From memory foam mattresses to hybrids that keep you cool all night long, Lisa's mattresses offer exceptional comfort and support with free delivery and 100 nights to try out your mattress in the comfort of your home. For a limited time, save up to $700 off select mattresses plus two free pillows. Go to lisa.com/iHeart for an additional $50 off mattresses and select goods. Exclusions apply. See lisa.com for more details.
Apologize for the sun glaring because the sun is setting where I'm at, so it's like a bright light. Well, it makes me look more a little heavenly or a little angelic. Hopefully for the topic at hand, it will hopefully have more of an angelic tones and overtures. Okay, I'm going to let Pastor Kathy kick it off and introduce and talk a little bit about it, and then I'll launch into my intro. Without further ado, Pastor Kathy, please.
Hi, you guys. I know a lot of you guys know me, and you're probably like, oh my gosh, she really wears a collar. Yeah, I do. Mm-hmm. I wanted to look professional. I even put on a little makeup for Theo. But I want to welcome all of you here. And a lot of us have been getting together, and we've all been talking. A lot of you have been out protesting, and trying to learn to come together in solidarity, not just on the issue of Black lives, but all of the things that a lot of us are just, we've just gotten to a place where we're dissatisfied, you know, and I think we can all agree about that. But a lot of them hinge on the racial climate, because Black people are more likely to be unhoused, Black people are more likely to have COVID, so forth and so on. And I don't want to take away from Theo's thunder, but he invited you here tonight to meet, as he always says, in the light of understanding. And we'd also like for everybody to remember that this is the light of respect. This is the light where we all want to be heard, where we want you to be able to feel safe and honest. If someone comes in here and disrespects you, just hit me out. I'll get the cane out and pull him off stage. Corinne Ho is also co-hosting with us. And what she's going to try to keep up with, because we don't know how big this can get, she's going to try to keep up with raised hands after Theo is given. And then she will unmute you so you can speak, because I ain't gonna be able to keep up with y'all. But so what I would like you guys to do is to listen as Theo brings us together, and then he'll open the floor. And I will ask you all to come and meet together with us in the light of understanding. And remember, this is not the light of chaos, okay? God bless you all. Let's get started. Theo?
Thank you, Pastor Kathy. I want to start off with something where many people have heard of him. He stated this. Dr. King said, people hate each other because they fear each other. And they fear each other and because they don't know each other. And because they are not communicated, and they don't communicate because they're not connected. Meeting in the light of understanding is the opportunity to connect with one another and to speak honestly about very thorny issues that we might not mention in polite society. To that end, I want to also talk about some uncomfortable questions and how it relates to being unhoused and as a person of color, as a Black person. There are certain things that we need to make a note of. For example, African-Americans is over 40% likely to unhoused of the population that we have, in as much that we also have the higher incidences of police reports, police brutality instances, as well as the response on how people look at African-Americans or Black Americans in the light when they are seen not to be conforming to supposed standards. And so I'm gonna open up with a softball question. And I want to say, do you think there is a link between police brutality and houselessness? And what does that look like? And please, raise your hand or however you want to do it. Again, we have the ability to mute other people so you can get your voice heard. And I'm willing to hear some insights or some takes on that. Harry's has his hand up.
I'm not sure if I see a link. I'm not out in the encampments like some folks here, like Kathy, to actually witness very often what is going on out there. But, I almost feel like homelessness or unhousedness is maybe one place where, in regards to the police, it may be colorblind, that because they seem to not, at least from what I hear, to not really discriminate as far as who the people are. They just see them as unhoused, that they don't want there, and they harass them during sweeps and whatnot. So I'm not sure if I see that link, but I can't say it from an educated point of view, because only because I haven't witnessed it.
Interesting.
DQ is on stack, so I'll go ahead and unmute him.
Thanks. I don't want to get too in the way. I'll just say I'm a member of Street Watch with Theo, and something that comes to mind is what our friend Aspen was just talking about, is that there is police brutality often used in sweeps, and especially in interactions where it's not being filmed or observed by anyone but those living in encampments. And I feel like a common story too that comes to mind, and I'll get out of the way, is especially our female identifying comrades who are out there on the street who have not been believed on a call to the police about domestic abuse, and it's often blamed the other way on the person being abused. So those are two things that come to mind with police brutality, either driving or perpetuating or causing homelessness. Thanks.
Just to give you some background, there is a higher, Hannah is up. Yeah.
Hi, I have to think a little bit before raising my hand. But yeah, I feel like police brutality is an animal all its own. And it just goes after the most vulnerable or the people who they feel like have the least power. So in that case, I do feel like there is definitely a link between people who are experiencing homelessness and police brutality. I mean, I'm from Seattle originally, and so there's like all these sweeps happening, and it's absolutely violent and brutal. Like, people's belongings are being trashed, and their houses are being or their shelters are being destroyed. So there is absolutely some kind of disease happening within the police who are treating humans this way. So I feel like it's mostly the structure of the police itself, where it's mostly enforcing, I don't know, the protection of capital and like home values, property values and whatnot. And so it's like taking out on people who are experiencing homelessness. So those are some thoughts I had. Thank you.
One of the things that I've been following and I wanted to say is that many people believe we all are equal when we are unhoused, and that is not exactly true. In fact, if you see the records or the citations or the arrest records, you will see there's a higher rate of unhoused Black people that have been cited or over or criminalized than conversely our white unhoused residents. This is not to say that they don't receive police harassment, but the records speak for themselves, and it lends a belief system that it's colorblind. Police brutality is colorblind, and that is just simply not the case. One of the difficulties of reason why maybe not of it is not always reported, and I can speak from my own and personal experience, it's because I'm an African American person, and I'm not believed when I experience the brutality. Where conversely, if a person maybe is white, they can probably go a little further, or things could get a little bit more resolved if they were to make a complaint. I have another question, and this one kind of delves into a little bit personally. How has the Pastor Kathy has something.
Michael O'Shea is unstacked.
Oh, yes, go ahead, Mike. I'm sorry, I didn't see you.
Yeah, I just wanted to speak to what you just said there, Theo. I know a lot of times those of us who are trying to engage the house community to build the bridges of understanding, there's a great misconception between of this concept of a good houseless person and a bad houseless person. And I think it's important to understand where racial perceptions feed into that, and where those biases play into this notion of who is a worthy story and who is not have a worthy story. That's all I
understand. Anyone else? Ah, Harry again.
This is a question based on what I'm hearing so far. And at the Interfaith Solidarity Network, of which I'm a board member, we actually just had a discussion recently about, trying our best when we're having conversation to be respectful and to use words that are respectful and to say the right thing. And I'm noticing tonight the term houseless, and, I've used the term unhoused quite a bit in the last few months. And before that, we said homeless. Is houseless kind of a new term that's making its way that's more respectful, or is that just another term that's out there?
Well, I'm going to say, give you the explanation why I'm saying unhoused and houseless, because some people also use structurally challenged. Some are using housing insecure. It's because there is a movement, because too often than not, people are putting the labels on us, and we are trying to create an agency that is a little bit more proactive, as well as less finger wagging or negative. Like, for example, transient. Police love to use that. And I see that in some communities that disdain unhoused people. Secondly, another one is hobo or vagrant. It always has a tinge of criminality to it. So in so far as when I say I'm unhoused, it's because I do not have a place, and I've had a place to stay. I can also say structurally challenged or houseless. But there are some unhoused or homeless people that like the term homeless, because it's okay. It's just like one of the similarities of what we call Black or African-American. This is a evolution of communication and an evolution of thought about how we want to be recognized and thought of.
So we just wanted to kind of add a little bit of perspective that we see here in Studio City, and building on what Michael said in answer to your awesome question, Theo, that a lot of the police brutality is also built on, as Michael was saying, people's perception of the unhoused population. And a lot of that comes down to a predominantly white neighborhood, also racially profiling people, and are more likely to call the police on a Black unhoused person than they are on a white unhoused person.
Yeah, in respect to your comment on police brutality and the link, when our laws are set up in a way that we are making people's existence basically illegal or poverty illegal, you're dealing with an inherent increased police presence around that, and along with an increased police presence can come more police brutality. So it's kind of a, maybe not a 1-2 step, but it's definitely on its way.
Very well put, because recently the LA Times have included a 26% increase in the use of force. I want you to put that in mind in the light of like what Officer Derek Chauvin, Michael Ferguson, and Freddie Gray, he may not have been unhoused, but he certainly seemed to be housed and secure because he's selling loose cigarettes. So there is definitely a link to this that is overlooked, because I've seen white unhoused people being, to be sure, maybe hassled, but it's never to the extent, for example, of unhoused African-Americans. I can speak for my example. When I one night was sleeping, they rousted majority of the unhoused African-Americans on one side of the street, and there was maybe three white unhoused people on it. They didn't even bother them. We had to get up from our things. We had to be patted down. Our name had to be through the database, and that took over like 45 to 50 minutes at 2:30 in the morning. And after that, we were told, you know, we need to extricate the area, leave the area. And so therein lies the reality of it. And those white unhoused were still there, and they were not touched at all. So I'll pass it, Kevin.
All right, I wanted to speak to two questions and be really brief. To Harry about, I agree with Theo. It's like people ask me, do I call you African-American or Black or whatever? I'm like, what is your heart's intention? But I think the one thing that I've heard people who are unhoused say is that they don't like to be called that homeless. Like, I've been at like council meetings, and people are like, that homeless hit me, or that homeless, you know. I mean, you could say, you know, a homeless person did this, or a person who's unhoused did that. I like the way everyone in describes it as people who are experiencing homelessness, and it's really become a part of my vernacular. So I think it depends on the heart, you know, and, you know, how we describe people. Then I wanted to speak to your other question, Theo, and also to what Stephanie and Brian said, is that because I work in the West Valley, I don't work on Skid Row. So me seeing a Black person to serve is far and few between. So I serve a lot of people who are white and some that are Hispanic, but mostly white. And they do go through police brutality, but I haven't seen like brutal beatings and some of the stuff that we've witnessed happen, you know, to the unhoused, you know, in LA proper. So, but they are harassed. They're waking up at 4 and 5 in the morning and saying, you know, you have 30 minutes or 15 minutes to get your stuff, and whatever you can't carry is going to be bulldozed away. But it's a different kind of harassment. Yeah. Do they die? Yeah, they may die from exposure or some of the bad laws, but I'm sure people have died of police brutality and vigilantism, but that's all I wanted to say about that.
Ken Ross is next. I have a question before I go into the next.
Hi, everybody. This is the first time attending this meeting. I want to thank Kathy for inviting me. I just had a very general question. I apologize for my ignorance, but I wanted to know, is this a forum for discussion, or is this an action type group?
Now, this is meeting in the light of understanding, where we have a discussion and ask the hard questions with people that have witnessed the protests, as well as wanting to further the conversation of helplessness among African Americans or Black Americans in this country.
Okay. So you don't deal basically with council files, let's say, to try to make some changes for the unhoused? That's not something that's a consideration, because that's what I would be interested in trying to make a change.
Basically, this meeting is just like, it could be like a town hall. Most of us don't even know each other. Mm-hmm. Theo just wanted to bring with, you know, you have the white community, you have people who want to be anti-racist, and you have, you know, people who want to know what they can do, yada, yada, yada. So he, go on, Theo, you can explain. Yeah. The rest. We're not a club, we're not a group, we're not an organization.
And many of us in this group, to be sure, are activists, and we do different direct actions, but this is not the purpose of this meeting. This meeting is a meeting in the line of understanding, where we have honest, hard conversations about this thorny issue, which is race. Which leads me up to the next question, is how has the protest Corinne.
Just to interject, thank you, Theo. Just to interject here to Ken Ross, the CIS, you're talking about community impact statement is specifically only just for neighborhood council system, of which I know you're a part of. So just wanted to let you know that.
I mean, I just found out today that there's a bill that was introduced in the assembly against chokeholds. So I don't know if that's purview to something.
Well, that's a good follow-up to the question I have here. How has the protest affected everyone personally? Catherine McKinney has a comment.
Yes, thank you for holding this forum, Theo. This is great. I have just a couple things that have been running through my mind.
Okay.
First thought is the LASA just announced via Twitter that they're going to come out with their homeless numbers within, I think, a few days. And we're going to get bombarded with information about, and it's going to be real, it's going to be written about, it's going to be talked about, it's going to be debated. There's going to be like a lot of information coming out soon about the new homeless count. My just thought off the top of my head, I don't know why it came to me in this forum, but I feel like LASA spends way too much time on these homeless counts, and they really like to pat themselves on the back. And I mean, just it's an immense amount of time spent on getting the count, and then tallying up the information and running it through academia and then pushing it out. And it's like, are we even getting, like, is there any bang for our buck? I feel like that all that time and energy could be better spent helping people. And that's all I want to say.
Thank you for that, Kathy. I think there's two sides to that. They probably want to have, and I'm not justifying LASA because I have my own issues with it, but they also, in order for it to make an educated conversation about the unhouseless crisis, which I dare say that there's going to probably explode due to the COVID-19 and the lack of income. We are talking about approximately over 120,000 people that are in houses will be hitting the streets very soon. So I think they're trying to get the hard numbers as quick as we possibly can in order for, I think the city in some respect, just take the issue of houselessness very seriously and to move away from some of the deleterious ideas that people think about unhoused people. I would like to change tax for a moment, and I wanted to ask people, how has the protest affected you personally? And I want us to be honest and to really think about that. How have these protests affected us? Don't everyone speak at once. Oh, Bintu is up.
Yeah, so.
Good evening, Bintu.
Good evening. I mean, just personally as a Black man, I'm also just a worker, right? I'm a guy who's an employee at a company. And, so unfortunately I myself haven't been able to be out there kind of engaging in that, on the street activism myself. So I can only say that I appreciate, everybody who's been out there protesting because my heart is with them 1,000%. We've still got people on the internet using Black Lives Matter's initials, BLM, and still saying this is a quote unquote terrorist group. You know, that thought, that thinking is out there when literally the purpose of the hashtag and the movement Black Lives Matter is in the name. It's so obvious. I think we've hit a watershed moment, and people are finally, there's enough momentum behind the movement that people are starting to get it in terms of, like, from a mainstream perspective. So without the protests, without on the street activism, without that, I think you wouldn't be here where, you know, people are now, you know, kind of like jumping on the bandwagon to, you know, show that they're not racist and show that they believe that Black Lives Matter, because, you know, in the end of the, at the end of the day, the protests, the movement, it's about freaking humanity, you know? It's about saving lives, where the lives that were being taken were kind of being swept under the rug.
Well said, Pintu. Thank you for that. Joanna was first, and then Hannah is second on stack.
Hey, can you guys hear me?
Yes, Joanna. Hello.
Happy and Thea. I want to echo Pintu, just the obnoxious reality that people are using a phrase like Black Lives Matter or anti-fascist as a weapon against community organizers. It's pretty telling of like who we're up against. But in that light, I feel like I've seen a lot of my kind of non-politicized white friends like joining, and maybe for the first time really seeing police brutality in a way that they hadn't as privileged folks in the society. And yeah, some of that is probably disingenuous, and like, you know, like I've seen a lot of BLM spray painted on stores that are, you know, complicit in gentrification and criminalization, but seeing a different kind of signing on from the like silent majority or whatever than we saw during Ferguson, for example, like some form of understanding that's growing. And a lot of more work to do, but it's pretty interesting when you see like just normie white people recognize what a killer cop looks like.
Anna was next. Thank you very much, Joanna.
Hi. So for myself, I'm an Asian American, and some of this discussion really brings about a lot of conversations about anti-Blackness within the Asian community. And I was really involved with Andrew Yang's campaign, so I got to know a lot of people who were previously not politically active. And now they're, you know, all over my Facebook feed now, and just having to have some really difficult conversations with them about what this means, and like people nitpicking at the term defund the police, you know, and just really getting into these tough conversations with people. So it's been nice to get into that dialogue. I mean, some people are like, they're just not getting it. They obviously have like a position and they're not going to change. But there are others who, you know, you can push a little bit toward in the right direction, and others where I feel, I guess, more solidarity. It's like, oh, hey, you and I are on the same page. So it's been a spectrum of, figuring out what my relationships are with people, and also wanting to get more involved. But yeah, and also at the same time, I'm not talking to my parents because of this. Like, no. They've been ignoring me for the past week because they don't truly understand why this is happening and why I need to be involved in this way. So yeah, there's a lot of interesting conversations happening in the Asian American community.
Thank you. It takes true courage to have the most difficult conversation with people close to us. I find myself it's a lot difficult sometimes to have the issues of being housed with my families than my friends, because you have a certain detachment. But if you have love and almost family duty or those kind of issues that crop up, it's become exceedingly very difficult to try to educate the older generation. And sometimes Harry is next.
Yes.
I'm unmuted.
Okay.
So you asked our thoughts on the demonstrations. You and I had a short conversation maybe yesterday about the marches out there, and you know, we both kind of agreed that a march is really just a parade, and a parade really doesn't get a whole lot changed. Now, I think, there are advantages, to the demonstrations and marches, one of which is showing that there is, a large amount of people from across the country that see this as a problem. And it's good to recognize that that there are a lot of people that that are interested in change. Also, perhaps it's an opportunity to for people that don't know each other to have a conversation during these marches and get to know each other a little better, because you know that's what brings everybody closer together, is to know each other better and to see, you know, how many ways we're all alike. So I think in that way they're good to a certain extent, but there needs to be another component of some sort in order to bring change. And I certainly am not one to advocate for violence, but you do notice that when there is violence, that's when suddenly it seems that suggestion for change, and even in some case change, is made. So I think we need to find that middle ground between just being there and being violent. There has to be a middle ground there where there's something that can help to bring about change without hurting other people, and that includes hurting, their property. So that's my thoughts.
John F. Kennedy said this, those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable. So there is something to be said about personal property. And when I said, a protest with permission is a parade. So if we do it according to the standards of white or Western sensibilities or delusional sensibilities, we run the risk of them just taking, we're just a toothless tiger. We're just out there roaring and no one's really giving us any kind of headway. But so there has to be some kind of impetus to make them to get up off their behind or get up on their knees and kneel with us or pray with us, whatever it is, to get some enacting of change. And I didn't ignore, I want to get Mr. Mitrio, Leon. Leon's next on it.
Hi, hello everybody. I found this meeting on Twitter. I don't know if you can hear me.
Yes, welcome.
Okay, thank you so much, Theo. I joined this meeting because of what it talked about, the unhoused people. And yes, I think the question that you made was not our thoughts on the demonstration, but how have these demonstrations or these protesters affected us? And I think at least my answer is that it hasn't affected me, because I'm doing the quarantine in my house. I am privileged enough to be a teacher who gives classes through the internet. So I'm thinking, and I'm seeing on Twitter, on the internet, images of people who are unhoused being caught in the middle of the fire, of what's going on, being literal or metaphorical fire. So I joined this meeting because I want to hear, I want to understand how, in what ways we can help, and what ways, because it's an image, it hurts to see somebody who can't escape. They don't have any house to go to after a protest, or they're really getting the worst of it. That's all I wanted to say.
I wanted to touch a little bit basic on it. Episode 26 of We the Unhoused, episode 25 was about the protesters and have their perspective. But episode 26, I inverted and asked people in my community, particularly Black men, about the protest. And each one that I've interviewed have stated instances where police have gone out of their way to target them and give them extra time or criminalize them. And some of them, they are very grateful for the protest, because it brings in a sharper relief of what the issue is. But sometimes, even when we talk about Black Lives Matter, sometimes there's housed Blacks, and we omit and we forget there's unhoused Blacks that have a higher rate of rate of criminality, because we're out on the street. We're in basic sometimes in white neighborhoods, because where we can probably panhandle or get more money instead of a distressed neighborhood, we're out there and all it takes is one of the people of a privileged class to form a neighborhood council or a business improvement district committee. And then they get together with a senior lead officer and a neighborhood prosecutor, and then you're off in trying to get rid of this unhoused person, particularly one over in Playa del Rey or Skid Row. I'm thinking of Annie, who got arrested over 87 times just for sleeping on the sidewalk during the Safer City Initiative. These things are tangible in the respect that this is visceral for them. They can speak on this as well as I can. I had 13 cops come to me and throw me out of a park on a rainy day in the rain and leave my things out there and got it thrown in the trash and all that kind of stuff. So it's a visceral response to this. I don't want to spend an exorbitant amount of time on that one because I want to get to the next question.
I think Joanna's on staff.
Oh, okay, Joanna.
Sorry, just a quick response to the earlier kind of conflating violence. I feel like violence is the infliction of trauma specifically on a body, and a building does not feel trauma. That's all.
Excellently put, because I was going to add up and a follow up of that question is, why do people feel that Black lives matter less than property or animals? People went into a rage when Mike Vick abused the animals, but when there the riots or when protesters had maybe defaced the building and people I've seen in my own experience have completely eclipsed the conversation about the building. I'll give you a case in point. And an excellent reporter I advise all of you to follow is Michael Kokot. Adrian Riskin delves into the issues of it. And in one of the Pacific Palisades Business Improvement District meetings, this majority of white individuals were talking about their buildings during the protest. No mention of George Floyd, no mention of the police brutality, and this is their direct quote. And you can go online and hear it from themselves. The police and the National Guard will keep us safe. I want you to think about that, because that question ties into why do people think Black lives matter less than property or animals? Pastor Kathy?
I'm gonna answer this as a Black American, and also I'm probably a little bit closer to slavery. My grandmother, my mother's stepmother, was a sharecropper. So they had just come out of slavery. And I think that a lot of that spills over, a lot of that attitude, the belief, the behavior, you know. I mean, we didn't come over here in a first class cabin of a cruise ship. We came in the belly of a ship, stacked body on top of each other, the whole trip, you know, bent over, you know, huddling together. And like people always say, when Black people were slaves, you know, y'all were slaves. Well, no, we were made to be indentured servants, you know. Everybody talks about privilege. We have privileges. That's why I keep telling everybody, I think white privilege is a delusion, you know. We have Black privilege, you know, our ancestors in Africa, the privileges were revoked and we were brought here. And so anybody's privilege can be revoked. I think that, so that carries over because we, you know, I say we because collectively, you know, the Black experience, but our ancestors, they were treated as slaves, you know. They were like, people didn't have to have a meal when you could have, you know, a big Black buck pull the hoe or the tiller, you know, the rope. They didn't have a rope, but the tiller, or, you know, they were used for, the men and women were mated, like we made dogs, you know, like look at their teeth. And, you know, if any of you guys get it, I went to college in Charleston, South Carolina. And, you know, in Charleston, they still have the slave market downtown where, and it's really like crazy to go and see where slaves actually stood on the shore. And they have pictures and shackles and all of that. And so they were treated like animals, and that didn't stop then, even though, you know, some right, they were freed from slavery, sorta, you know. Even in the 60s, you know, in the 50s, I'm a child of the 50s, but growing up, you know, there was still that same kind of thing that you did. Like, think about the civil rights marches, like you guys are protesting now. And I'm going to speak to that, but I'm going to speak later. But you guys are protesting now. Back then, you know, dogs were sicked on them. You know, they sicked dogs on them. They use water hoses, you know, to wash them, like washing the dirt off the street. And so this is the history of, those were peaceful protests, you know, those were peaceful protests. And that is what John F. Kennedy was talking about. That was peace, you know. And Colin, when he knelt, that was peace, you know. So basically what the African-American has learned, or the Black person, is that or the Negro, or the colored person, whatever you want to call me. But what we have learned here in America is we're not allowed to protest, which means that I'm not considered to be an American. I'm not considered to be 100% a part of this. Even they still have laws like, say my baby is his father's white. Y'all don't acknowledge him as white. Y'all didn't ever say Obama was the white president, but he was. His mother was white, you know? But so those little Jim Crow things are still there. No one, I've never heard anybody call Obama the white president but me. And his mother was white. You know, but I had to raise my son, I don't care. You are Black. And I think we have to look at that. That stuff comes, so a lot of the filth of being enslaved is still here. And, you know, it's like you still wanna put a yoke around the neck so that people, you know, behave. But, you know, it's like Colin, he knelt, he tried, you know, we all knelt, we held our collective throats and said, I can't breathe. You know, we walked around and said, don't shoot. You know, is it gonna be me next? All of that, it was peaceful. And after a while, you know, how unmoved can you be seeing unarmed Black citizens being killed? There has to be, we have to admit that there's something to that, or there's something wrong with that, or we have to admit that we don't care. We're not even empathetic, you know? We have to admit that Black lives just don't matter to us. And I think that's an okay thing to say, you know? I mean, I've been in a lot of things, and a veteran is one of them. And I serve to defend your right to think and say what you want. And I will not invalidate your feelings, but I want to understand them. But that is what I've seen. I mean, I've seen the Black Panthers, the struggle, and it keeps going on. And how long do we have to struggle, you know, for civil rights? So if you say you have privilege and I don't, that's not privilege, that's bigotry. You're denying me the same privileges that you have. As an American, I have a right to the same privileges that you have. And the only privilege that any of us in this chat should be having, and I keep saying this because I want to get it through, not just to white America, but to Black America. I'm not marginalized. Marginalized means you can ignore me, set me to the side, I'm not there. You don't have to acknowledge me, but I will be acknowledged. I consider myself a Black woman of privilege. And I believe that I have the privilege to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I think the difference is that a lot of people feel like if you get rights, or if you, you know, if you get to exercise your rights, because they're your rights, whether they're my rights, whether you allow me to exercise them or not. But if you get the right to exercise your rights, like, they're gonna lose something. It's not gonna be any skin off their nose. And so I think in the end, you know, what I think that I would like for white America to know, because watching all these protests, I've seen my friends like, well, I'm out here because I have privilege. I'm like, go downtown go down on Melrose. Your privileges was revoked. You can't go shopping today. You know, your privileges can be revoked. Just like my ancestors' privileges were revoked. But the thing that I want people to know is that Black people, we're not even trying to get privilege. We don't want to live on the hill and look down on anybody. You know, you see the Black community, we just want peace. We want to be able to get a job. We want to be able to have peace. We want to be able to not have to deal with racism, period. Not with, from the police, not from our neighbor, not from anybody. We just want, I don't need any privileges. Any privilege I get is a privilege I create. But you, any privilege that is denied someone, if you deny me of privileges that are mine, then what is that? You took something from me that don't belong to you. So stop saying you have white privilege because you don't want to believe that about yourself. And I know a lot of you guys, that's not who you are, you know? White privilege is injustice, bigotry. White privilege is, if you say you have white privilege, that means that George Floyd needed to die because he had no privileges. And it was within Chauvin's privilege to have to murder him. And that's not right. So those things, we need to put the, I think the language or the narrative, as Theo would say, needs to change. So we are, the privileges that we all should have as Americans, as the great slave owner Thomas Jefferson said, is to know that we have the inalienable rights because we're all created equal by our creator to life, liberty, and the pursuit of justice. And I promise you, that's all we want. We don't want to take over America because I'm tired. I can't be the queen of America. I want to, but I can't. Go on, Theo.
Well, as a segue, is to that, because what she said historically is that we, no other race of people have been put in the law books as considered three-fifths human. No other law, no other conversation was had by the founders of America that had slave owners or brutal slave owners. And it has transformed because my family too, my grandmother was a sharecropper and my grandfather was, they were on the plantations and their parents and their grandparents were slaves and the transition through the reconstruction and all of that. But it also provoked them to become the fight for civil rights. And I don't usually talk too much about myself, but I will tell you the story about my uncle. My uncle had sassed a white woman down in Alabama. They were in Birmingham, Alabama. And when we say sass, that means he stood up for himself. He didn't look down on the ground. He didn't jump off the sidewalk fast enough and, you know, whatever. And return, and in response to that, the wife went home to her husband, who obviously was white as well, and they got what they call night riders. They got night riders together, convocated to, in that time, they would go in and kick families, like black families' doors in and snatch the male, or even sometimes the black female too, Mary Turner, or snatch the male in through, despite all of the protests and the families peacefully begging them not to do it. And they would get together and lynch black people. And this was a known thing. And my grandmother was completely upset and frantic and unfortunately, in the black community, we had Eastern Star and Black Masons. They were a little bit different than the white Masons. And the Masons, for black Masons, we were geared toward helping black people. And many of the Masons at the time were funeral directors. So the undertaker would create a false bottom for my uncle to be put under one of the deceased people on the top of the coffin to be shipped to the north. So to understand, this is a legacy that they didn't value black lives there. What is the excuse now? Why now in 2020, we are still going through the same thing that Fannie Lou Hamer went through in 1965? And that is something that really is alarming. And it brings more to light what JFK's words were in the 60s that it is today. There are a couple of people on stack. I think
I saw Bintu with a hand raised. I wasn't sure if Bintu still wanted to. Okay.
I try and keep it super brief. I'm really here to more to learn, you know, as a young activist in terms of homelessness. But just to speak on the issue of blackness, I just want to say, just to add to the narrative of what's kind of being spoken out here, that a couple things. One, I mean, I just want to say it for the record. I'm sure plenty of people are aware, but, you know, the black story, black history exists beyond slavery, like 1,000%. You know, I am the child of immigrants and of the diaspora. And so like the Black diaspora exists outside of slavery, also inside of slavery. Like I have Puerto Rican, relatives, and I have Haitian relatives. You know, there's all kinds of slavery and the defeat of slavery in those stories. So, you know, what Black does as a term and what white does as those two terms are both brutal, brutal terms. What they both do is through violence, smash entire collections of people into one story, into one group. Whiteness doesn't exist without brutality, and the term Black doesn't exist without brutality. It basically, the term Black forcibly connects people who would otherwise have been unrelated without the concept of whiteness. So basically you have Nigerians, you have Dominicans, you have all these different stories, but now there's beauty in Blackness, but I'm just saying we should like honor where everybody comes from, and we should realize just how brutal both of those terms really are, because whiteness also comes with the price. You know, American whiteness comes with the price of brutalizing people into poverty, and there's a trade-off that happens, and I don't want to get into it too much, but I just really wanted to speak on Blackness being kind of beyond slavery, because as Kathy was saying, you know, Black people existed before slavery existed.
I totally agree. Where I was going with that conversation is also due to our bloody history here in America, and how even though the Black diaspora, we were not just plucked just willy-nilly initially. We were, if there was the artisans, it was the agriculturalists, it was people that had skill in order to carve out a frontier in America. They didn't just snatch people just off just for the heck of it. They snatched people that had skill in order for us, because we had skilled in rice, we had brought over indigenous foods. But the point of it is, despite all of that, the ability of that, in America, there's still the idea that these people here in America, even among some of us that share some of the diaspora, we were considered animals, three-fifths human, beast of burden. And chattel slavery is the only thing that's ever known across the world that America has on its law books, despite great the Constitution is. The idea of chattel slavery and three-fifths human and Dred Scott case is versus Plessy is one of the things that we as American Blacks have been toiling with. And I'm not just in America, because UK, I'm hearing that they have racial upsets as well, but in all across the world, this experience, for some reason, over in Palestine, Africans over there, they're being run out. This is some reason that is tying in with a negative or sinister kind of element. Ken Ross.
Okay. In regard to what Kathy was saying and what Theo was saying, I'm kind of curious for a topic, if everyone here at this meeting is aware that one of the most contemporary issues, that one of the hottest issues right now in the country, is the topic of lynching. To the best of my understanding, the House of Representatives passed an anti-lynching bill, and President Trump and the Republicans have refused to allow that to come to the Senate floor, and therefore it will remain unvoted upon during this administration, most probability. So you have elements of the country in large groups of power that are not opposing lynching. Interesting.
Well, and you have to think lynching, which I'm going to put on my teacher hat right now, lynching, that term was thanks to a very courageous woman in a time where it was very widespread, and her name was Dr. Ida B. Wells Barnett. This Black woman was a very famous journalist, and she was very close to a very family man, much like Akai Gurley, George Floyd, and a jealous white shop owner got upset and seeing them being successful Blacks in their communities, and decided to go and loot and riot and tear up their businesses. Naturally, as people always say about defending their property, a fight ensued. So he, this white property owner, went and got enlisted, right, basically the Republicans of that time, and got a deputized, a lynch party to go out and hunt him down and brutalize and beat him, cut his fingers off, castrate him, I mean, just do all kind of horrific things. And that right there propelled Ida B. Wells to step forward and give a journalistic account about where did they take the bodies and what they did to them. And she went out and started to investigate it, lynching cases such as that. So jump forward to 1955, a young boy in 1955 was sent down to Money, Mississippi to stay with their grandparents. And as a kid usually do, they seen women, saw this woman and catcalled her or whistled at her. And this white woman became offended and talked to her husband. And her husband and brother kicked in their grandfather's door, dragged him out in the middle of the night, beat him severely, shot him in the eye, hung him with a cotton gin, and threw him in the river. When his body was found 3 days later, of course, he was badly decomposed and badly disfigured. And so they threw him in a box, not a coffin, a half-shaped little box, sealed it, and sent it to Chicago. Understandably, the mother was bereft with grief and sadness, and she wanted to say goodbye to her only son. They strongly recommend advised against it. She pushed the undertaker to open the coffin, and what she beheld was very horrific and sickening. She made the decision to have her son have an open casket funeral because she wanted the world to see what they did to that her son. And that young man, his name was Emmett Till. And this was in 1955. And now we're in 2020 within the same issue as we're trying to have a bunch of people who were probably not born or were on the end of it, that's still trying to perpetuate a same heinous kind of thought process to the next generation. So my last question is how many of you have invited Black people, housed and unhoused, to your home?
I'm gonna jump in here. I have a lot of friends that are unhoused, of course. You know, I make friends fast, so my house is always full of kind of everybody. My family, my friends, my everything is the, I would call it the Rainbow Coalition. Jesse Jackson used to have a group in Chicago called that.
Yep.
But, Theo, could I expound on your question?
Yes, please.
Out of order?
Oh, go ahead.
What I would ask is, how many of you have had someone that was not of your ethnicity in your home?
Amy has on stack.
I'm getting there.
No problem.
I was typing something.
Yeah. No.
Where is Amy?
Hi, I'm Casey. Oh, I'm on Amy's phone.
Oh, okay. Hey, Casey. Sorry about that.
Yeah, hey. Thank you so much for doing this. I'm here with Amy. And she was just reminding me that maybe a year or so ago, we had met this young gentleman at a dinner for the unhoused, and he had a guitar, and I figured maybe this is an individual that I can kind of get close to and kind of see if there's any connection that I can make, because it's awkward, you know, we're all trying to find ways of connection. And luckily I was working for Facebook, and I said, hey, you want to come to my house and see if maybe we can record you? And he was unhoused at the time. And he said, sure, I'd be happy to. And I started hearing his story about how he had been targeted by the police for, you know, you fit the description, same thing. Just they pulled him out of his job in broad daylight. His cell phone on his, he said, can I grab my cell phone? They said, no. And he ended up in jail for 3 years, unjustly accused of something that he had nothing to do with. And they finally, you know, let him back out of the prison. And then he was on, you know, back on the streets, not knowing what to do. And the police said, don't ever show your face again. they treated him very poorly, but we were able to connect. And just, he's a, was a real example of resilience that through whatever he was dealing with, he kept his, just his composure was beautiful. Even though he's been, he continues to go through the ups and downs of life, just had his house broken into again a few, like a week ago, but just a real beautiful example. So yeah, he's become a good friend and we check in often. And yeah, so I think it's the little things we can try to do, but they make a little difference, I guess, in time.
One of the things that I wanted to also point out too is that there was a similar story that we have, a very clear cut case of police brutality, but this was a 16-year-old black young man. His name was Khalif Browder. Actually, I spoke with one of the family members, and he was locked in jail for over, I think it was like 3 years, and he ended up killing himself due to police violence and brutality because they thought he stole someone's backpack.
Yeah.
But these cases, these conversations, when people say that we are get criminalized the same, these things are the untold stories about what's going on, and the world is not really aware fully the gravity of the situation and why, when you see things and when blacks are up in uproar, it's because this has been going on too long. We've done the respectable ideas of protest, kneeling and hands up, shoot, it can't shoot. And incidentally, while we were doing that, I want to point out there were police officers running around with shirts on, with of course, with some black people that we call bootlickers, running on with a sign that says, "I can breathe." So these things, this which brings up another question, is what is the obsession with giving police officers untold power at, from the point of $3.1 billion that they already have and always over 54% of a budget to continue to terrorize people of color? Jane Elliott always said, and I always have said this too, and I believe this is a good one, if any of you follow her, if you know, well, you know what's going on with Black Community Night right now. Would any of you trade places with Black people right now?
Thank you, Theo, for putting on this conversation, this space that allows a difficult, much needed and honest conversation. I feel that once we pass the protest, the march phase, I hope that everyone will go to work. We have a great momentum. We can see that change can happen like this. We're sorry that someone has to pay for his life and their lives to get us here, but change can really happen. And of course, there are a lot of things to do after these reforms. There are a lot of, you know, the criminal justice reform, the look at the police use of force policy, the Board of Right, there's all kind, make a use of force on a national level and standardize it. There's all kind of things to do. So I hope that people will really go to work, because power in number is what works. But I also feel that once we go to work, each of us have to really focus on what it means to accept one another. I mean, really, really, not just in rhetorics or in singing or in poetry, but really in our daily lives.
Yeah.
How do we relate to each other? There are, you know, cases in daily lives where someone could treat another person of a person of color in the most mundane way, but shows a racist treatment, for lack of a better word. I mean, to put it bluntly. And I hope that the people who perpetuate those actions take a time to reflect within themselves and say, how can I change myself so that I'm acting in a more accepting way towards this other person who has a different color than I am, you know? And language, like Pastor Kathy said earlier, language is also important. You know, I wasn't aware about the white privilege concept, but now I am. There are a lot of people like me who say, you know, I don't see your color, but really meant in a good way, as in, I really don't see your color. I see you as a person and I accept you in all your entirety. But I think in the light of the, under the context and in the light of history, it's important to take a step back and say, no, I see your color actually. I do, I see you. And so sometimes we might say things that we mean well, but we don't know. So I think we as a society ought to come to an understanding of the words that we use. So thank you for this.
Well, that's what being in the light of understanding means. Thank you very much.
Joanna may have a comment about Black Lives Matter and lynching. I don't know if she wanted to speak.
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to kind of push back on the idea that legislation alone will stop systemic racism because the system is racist. So I think a couple years ago, a BLM activist was charged with using California's anti-lynching laws that exist already. Black women charged with lynching, which they define, it was not a violent crime in that sense. It would be nice if lynching were illegal, but now, unfortunately, it's been legalized through the use of police brutality. So.
Also, I wanted to piggyback off of what Corinne said, and I wanted to want you to digest this or let it marinate. There may be times when we are powerless to prevent injustice, but there must never be a time when we fail to protest. And that is Eli Wisley. And if you ever read his book on Night, he details living through the Holocaust. And he talks about the necessity of standing up and to speaking out against injustice. So if there's anything I hope to accomplish is that if you see injustice, that we may at the moment be temporarily powerless, but we must protest. We must stand out and say something. We must do something. And Dr. King says this, and I want to also point this out. We who engage in nonviolent direct action are not the creators of tension. We merely bring to the surface the hidden tension that is already alive. So obviously there is some kind of tension that's been going on against Black Lives, which hence the name Black Lives Matter. So what is the next question I have is, what is the opinion on All Lives Matter? And I want an honest opinion. Why do people always want to throw that out when Black Lives Matter is speaking?
I hope you guys know this is a judgment-free zone. And yes. We really, just like you want to hear what we think about this, this is not a one-sided thing. I don't, yeah. I want to remember who said this, and I don't want to take somebody's credit, but somebody was saying this is kind of like an all of us kind of deal. So we want to hear, you know, also, because we're learning too. We're learning too. We're meeting in the light of understanding.
I was going to say, if no one asked, I'm going to be go back in teacher mode, and I'm going to pick people to say something.
You're unmuted, Steve.
Thank you. My concern is injustice that exists, whether or not you're Black, whether or not you're disabled, whether or not you're unhoused, whether or not you're Jewish. There's a whole set of categories that if we talk about inclusion, we need to remember that, yes, it's important to be thinking about Black Lives Matter, but in the phrase of All Lives Matter, we show ignorance and disrespect for people of all colors, of all religions, of all nationalities, of all abilities or disabilities. And we don't always think about that.
I would like to say on the matter of that, we are a blaming and shaming society. I've said this many times on my podcast. But to the question of Black Lives Matter, we've been going through this grappling with this issue since we got off the boat. And it is, and unfortunately, the future of all of the other groups that you've mentioned, Steve, it hangs in the balance within the treatment and the justice that needs to happen with Black liberation. James Baldwin says, our future is bright or as bright or as dim as white society chooses to act or don't act. So therein lies the issue. The issue is that ingrained system that is so insidious that we have taken the drinking from this poison and is infecting the entire country.
Jed is on stack.
Jed's next.
Yeah.
Hey, Jed.
Hey, Theo, how are you?
Hey, Jed.
I mean, not to, you know, put things into numbers and percentages, but the fact is, historically, Black lives have been disproportionately exploited, murdered, neglected, and abandoned in this country, and I would probably say across the globe. And so if you say all lives matter, you have to start with saying and highlighting Black lives that have been abandoned and neglected and murdered in such a disproportionate number and made homeless here in LA. It's disgusting to counter Black Lives Matter with All Lives Matter. And I think that there will be no liberation of all people until there is Black liberation. There will be no justice in Los Angeles until there is justice in Skid Row, right? You know, the most neglected, policed, impoverished neighborhood in the city that is also disproportionately Black.
Yep.
And I'm just going to leave it at that.
Harry was next.
Oh, okay.
So I just want to put it really simply. This is how I feel. I think too many Black lives shatter. And so the movement Black Lives Matter is needed.
That was nice. I'm going to steal it. Harry. I'm stealing it.
Stephanie and Brian.
So I just, that, you know, the problem with a phrase like all lives matter is that it seems like a very well-intentioned phrase, but I, you know, unfortunately have yet to hear it independently that wasn't countering Black Lives Matter. It is always used as a way to kind of deflate a conversation or to deflect from an argument, or I've never heard the phrase all lives matter applied, you know, independently when something else happens. You know, when people are dying in prisons, when people are dying on the street, regardless of race or gender or age or ability, no one ever says all lives matter immediately then. It's only ever used as a counter to stop a conversation around Black lives and Black rights.
I wanted to say something, you know, and I'm not trying to, I think that there's an empathy from the Black community and I want everybody to understand that. Before this happened, you know, because I think COVID was just the perfect storm. I think George Floyd is the straw that broke the camel's back. I think we're collectively angry about a lot of social injustice, and most of us here being activists and advocates and, you know, just people who deal with social justice, that's our thing. I think that we know that. But before this, you know, one of the things that, I mean, a lot of you guys follow me, I'm sure you're like, why is she writing that? But I was really pushing that Asian Americans were being targeted and slaughtered and beaten up and slashed because of COVID. There was a Jewish community in New York. They were, you know, just attacking everybody because of COVID-19. They blamed them for it. When they were putting the pipeline through the reservation in Dakotas, I had that everywhere. You know, because I think most of us, if we're going to be honest, you know, that care about social justice, we have to admit that we care about humanity. We care about humanity. So tonight I asked a friend of mine if she would come on this call. And I ain't gonna name no names. Y'all don't know her, no way. But I asked her if she would come on this call. And she's a Hispanic American. And she goes, oh no, I know I should come on. She goes, but I don't like to get involved in that stuff. I'm looking at your page. Why are you posting all that stuff? You're gonna just cause more problems. I'm like, well, I'm not posting it to divide people. Every beautiful picture of me says resist the divide. So I'm not trying to divide people, but I feel like if I can post, and some of y'all know, if you can post every minute something that's happening in the Black community that's violent, some violence, I can post it all day long. That's, mm-hmm. And if that's what it takes for me to get someone to see what's happening in my community or to, you know, say, you know what, I want to stop and understand this. You know, it's not that I'm trying to blame you or bring out some delusional white guilt. Get away from that. I want you to open your eyes and go, this is happening. And so she refused. And I'm like, what if this was about the children that I've been, before this happened, you know, advocating for that are missing at the border, or, you know, Hispanic people in cages or immigration at all? You know, would you come to it? And she said she didn't think so. But she's a devout Christian. I asked her what if it was about Christians. She said she would come. I'm like, what good does that do? But so what I'm saying is if we don't learn to speak up for one another, and I think that the Black community, we have a voice and an empathy for other communities, and we do advocate whether people recognize it or not because we empathize. And I want everybody to empathize. And yes, Black Lives Matter. We see the little poster everywhere that says, you know, yes, all lives matter. But right now, this topic, this subject is about Black lives because those are the lives that are really being snuffed out for like little or nothing. And I saw a post where it says, you know, why is everybody up in arms and hate for us to talk about, you know, Black Lives Matter? You know, why do people hate, you know, people hate us to say that, you know? We hate to ask that. We hate to have to say, you know, my life matter. Why should I have to tell you my life matter? So until I think that, you know, society, and I agree with Jed, it's not just America, but society in general realizes the value of a Black life, you know, I could just continue listening the deaths and the violence in the against the Black community. You know, don't tell me, well, there's Black on Black crime, y'all killing each other. Child, I watch Snap, y'all killing each other. I watch Dateline ID, y'all killing each other. Mad. So, you know, we usually kill the people in our own community.
Exactly.
Yeah, if Aldo stopped messing with me this week, y'all gonna see me on Snap. So we kill the people in our own community. But what I'm saying is, that, you know, that's just like a distraction, you know, to, you don't want to talk about this, but our lives are not being handled in a way that is commensurate to all other lives. So we have to say Black Lives Matter, because if your life matters to me, then my life must matter to you. It must, you know? And so, yeah, we know all lives matter, you know, certainly I do. All lives matter. But today we're talking about Black lives because Black lives are in danger. You know, yeah, I have 5 sons, but one has passed away. I have 9 grandsons and I have 3 great grandsons. And I'm gonna tell you, I their lives matter to me and I want them to matter. And I'm like Jed, until their lives matter, you know, everybody wants peace and unity. That's what we're saying in a kumbaya moment. But if there's no justice, there will be no peace. There just can't. And I don't know if I expressed that well, but I'm going to shut up.
I wanted to point out something, too, about the Black Lives Matter thing. Because when people say Black Lives Matter, and then when they make a rejoinder and say All Lives Matter, the All Lives Matter group did not come out when this white person was being brutalized. It was the Black Lives Matter group that spoke his name. There's been instances where white people or Asian people or other people other than Black Lives Matter has been on the forefront and denouncing the violence and demanding for justice for them. So whenever we hear this this conversation about the other groups that are being this and that, this All Lives Matter group is nowhere to be found. And it's always used as a detracting tool or to deflect from the real relationship of the resentment of Black people having the temerity to demand for justice and their own humanity. We're closing upon the 8:30 hour, and I wanted to wrap this up and ask if anyone else have anything, thoughts, impressions about the group, because this is one of a 5-part series. I do believe that we've covered a lot of ground here, but I also think this is not one of those hidden and quit it kind of things or a one-time thing. I think this should be an evolution of a conversation, because there's other facets of this I want to talk about: the unhoused that have mental crises, the unhoused that may have substance use issues. These things, another topic, but this is for the next conversation. I want us to really delve into this.
This is Corinne. I was just going to say, before you said it's a first of 5-part series, I was just going to say it has to continue. The conversation, the discussion needs to continue.
Thank you, Corinne. I totally agree. And nice sign, Harry.
Well, I just want to say that this platform is open. And can I ask, is your name Leonel? It is? I want to tell you, because we didn't ask you a question. Theo, we didn't ask you.
Okay, what was the question?
And I keep saying, we're going to get back to that. What do we do in the midst of uprising, riot, protest, or demonstration when we see the unhoused being violated or they're helpless? And
Street Watch, or we have a Street Watch meeting that I'm part of. Street Watch. There are different organizations that we are already on the front line in making unhoused people as a harm reduction. One of the Street Watch's mission statements is about harm reduction. If we see some injustice, we don't just walk idly by. And sometimes what I've noticed when there has been brutality or brutalness with the police or the phone, there's been people that have, particularly when I was in Chinatown, I had parents when they were trying to vilify me because I was in the park as unhoused people was about to attack the children and things. Parents came to my defense. They got out their phone, they recorded, and they put those authorities on the spot and called them out. White, Asian, Black, it was so amazing, I couldn't believe it, that they just came to my defense to push back against that. And that told me that that's something that we all could do. You know, that it doesn't cost so much. We get involved with Street Watch. We go to the meetings. We learn how to report the police. We learn how to make sure we get to know our neighbors, because unhoused people, usually like myself, I lived in that community before I became unhoused. Many unhoused people usually live in the communities that they were evicted from. So we need to understand that. They're just not some interloper that just flop out of the outer galaxy and just drop there. They are there for a reason. You know, they're there for survival. There's restrooms maybe nearby, food or access. And then two, if they have to panhandle to make things ends meet before the first of the month or their EBT kicks in, there's a lot of things that are going on with unhoused people that the house community take for granted. So there, I strongly suggest many of us that are sitting here enroll into a Street Watch course and really learn what it is, the world of the unhoused, and how we need to be able to be a collective force and holding the accountable to Mayor Garcetti and the city councils and all over the district, and holding them accountable and says, these are our neighbors and this behavior is unacceptable and we're not going to stand for it.
Genevieve is a stack, but I want to say to Leonel, we all held up our phones. I do outreach. I didn't know what to do. I called Theo crying. He was like, join Streetwatch. And I joined Streetwatch. This is the best weapon, because you saw a lot of that because somebody filmed that man in that wheelchair. Yeah. You know, so everybody, your phone is, you know, and so now people are being prosecuted for him being hit in the face with a rubber bullet. And I would say, if you see anyone being hit in the face with a rubber bullet, and Joanna's just put the link. Joanna, thank you for putting all the links. And if you live in the San Fernando Valley, there is, we have Streetwatch here. I'm a part of Streetwatch San Fernando Valley. But, you know, if you see somebody, you know, doing stuff like that, even if you're near a protest, you know, I'm also an ex-cop. Don't tell nobody. Theo don't like that to be mentioned. But it was like, I swear, it was like 50 years, not 50 years ago, but at least 40 years ago. I was a cop, and they were just coming out with rubber bullets. I was telling Theo this, and it was upon the advent of them. They hadn't really gotten them. But the training is, do you know that they are not to be shot in someone's face? Mm. And so that is something that, you know, we need to report that. We need to, you know, there are laws, you know. So anyway, I Genevieve's on stack, but yeah, I just didn't want us to overlook your question, Leo.
Yeah, please.
We're not, Theo's rude, I'm not.
So Theo, going back to what you just asked, and I hope this will continue, so look forward to further conversations. So one of the things, I'm with Sela Neighborhood Homeless Coalition, and I see Mike and Josh are still on too. Sachin was also on the conversation, but I just wanted to like kind of let everybody know, we have had an SMS service, which Sachin, who's a software developer, had come up with like about a year and a half ago. And at the events that we do, our coverage area is Echo Park, Silver Lake, Los Feliz, Atwater Village, and some parts of East Hollywood. Mm. We go out and do street outreach, as well as have like two weekly events at churches in Silver Lake and Echo Park. And when we've encountered folks, you know, who do have cell phones, and it's always surprising, I think, to people when, you know, like there's this general public assumption that folks who are unhoused don't have cell phones or access to cell phones. What we have found in our experience, and, you know, like my own personal experience, is that it's not necessarily that they don't have access to cell phones, but they lose them and have them taken a lot more frequently than you or I would, who are housed. But the general numbers of folks who, you know, like in one time or another have phone access is roughly about the same as sort of like for LA folks who do have phones. So my point here is, we have this SMS service that we have asked, you know, people who voluntarily want to sign on to get information that, you know, is pushed out when we have like events that we know about, whether they're things that we're doing or other organizations are doing, you know, that have to do with sort of like, where can you access the basic resources like showers or food or other things. But particularly with respect to the protests, we, you know, when the curfew started happening, we found that we were able to use this SMS service as a way to let folks know who normally may not be able to connect, and also, you know, let their neighbors who don't have any kind of digital access to know that the curfews were in place. So that's one thing that we've been able to kind of think about, how we can purpose like the tools that are at our disposal to be able to share more, you know, like factual information with people. And we would invite folks to also, you know, like let us know if there's other things that you're doing on a regular basis that we may be able to help push out on this SMS platform.
May I piggyback off of that too? It is true that unhoused people have cell phones, but people because I am unhoused. So I want to clear about my own experiences with this. So there's no misunderstanding. Many unhoused people do have cell phones, but unfortunately during COVID-19, there lies a problem. I couldn't charge my phone. I couldn't keep up to date with information that was going on. I didn't even know that that there were certain seats in certain areas until I had to be able to find a charging station. The second issue was because the stores are on the places that I usually go has a very unhoused sentiment, and they cut down the charging places. The library wasn't open. So a lot of times the information pipeline can be compromised in that respect, that with things that are going on. And there are unhoused people that, like for example, are keeping their phones, keeping the information or the battery juice for the important calls like doctor appointments and things of that nature. But the long and short of it is that there is a percentage of people that have phones, but then there is the issue is that we are not able to charge our phones as expeditiously as possible. I want to leave you with the ending thought here, and then Pastor Kathy is going to close us out. If you are neutral in situations of injustice, you have chosen the side of the oppressor. So please remember that. And I thank you all for listening, and and thank you all for attending as well. And I hope again to meet in the light of understanding.
All right, you guys, I just want to say goodbye. Theo wanted me to pray for all of y'all, but I ain't going to do it. But what I am going to do is ask that you all be graced with blessings of good health, peace, safety, especially in these times, that we do find unity, you know, and that everybody here gets a bite at life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So thank you all for joining. I look forward to doing this again. Y'all, I just didn't want to have another kumbaya moment. You know, we can't sit around making each other feel, we can't sit around making each other feel comfortable. We have to, truth is painful sometimes. And so I hope you guys, everybody felt heard. And I hope next time everybody feels even more free to say what you feel and think. I know this is not easy. That's all I have to say. Corinne, any closing thoughts before we all say goodbye?
I'm glad to have been here tonight. I want to thank everybody for being here and let the conversation continue. We need this. We need this. They say the host go last, making sure everyone is going. Okay. Is Pastor Kathy gone?
No, she's still here.
Okay. I wanted to ask Bintu something. Okay, Bintu said a word, two words, right? Bintu said those two words. Don't say those. What were they? I missed it.
No, I mean, I think what I was saying, and I was just trying to make sure I was talking about whiteness and blackness, or the term white and the term black. That's all. And just, I was just basically trying to try to address those two words because they're kind of constricting, and I know they're shorthand, and, you know, but I was basically trying to address, you know, because those are just, you know, race is just a construct. You know, like black is beautiful, but also race is a construct, and it was made up, and it's used in America for brutality. So I was basically just addressing, you know, like a couple of ideas, just that, you know, black represents more than just our history post-slavery. Black existed before slavery. And I was trying to also exist on the other hand, also whiteness, the concept, is a brutal concept. And so I was just trying to like touch on that because it's just so much of a bigger thing beyond slavery. That's, you know, I just want, you know, for anybody who I know I'm not, you know, the most, I'm not trying to be the smartest or anything like that, just in case anybody who was present wasn't already exposed to that thinking, I just wanted to mention those thoughts.
Theo, may I ask a follow-up question?
Go ahead.
So I never heard whiteness and blackness.
Okay.
How is this used? In what context or in which sentence? Would it be more like to describe someone's color, or how is it usually used?
Well, if I put on my teaching hat again, I have to go and educate you from the big origins of this country. And this country created and met up with almost like the Nicene Conference and created this construct to delineate between the people that they captured and to afford them not only this construct, but generational wealth, generational power in order to dominate the people that they conquered and the people that they have enslaved. For example, for the indigenous people, they called them the red man or Indian. Before they called us black, it was not always that very nice. They called us Negroes, and these kind of things that germinated into this construct. The construct was always the dominant, was the person on the top of the tier was white. And from that measuring stick, if you did not join that group of class of people, and not always just white, wealthy white, then you were relegated into a pecking order. Because then it was the wealthy white, then it was called, or the Peckerwood. Then of course, anybody before the Asians were here, Native Americans, or indigenous Americans, I'm sorry, other groups had to fight for the crumbs off the table of the large rest of the egalitarians, or, you know, the rich. So therein lies why that term is so embedded in our cultural mores and standards.
Very helpful. Thank you.
No problem. Wow. Okay, so we should close this one out because I got to go to another one.
Okay.
These Zoom meetings. There.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you,
Bintu. Thank you too much.
Bye, Kathy. Bye. Bye, Theo.
open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cb for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Tired of restless nights? At Lisa, we know good sleep is essential for mental, physical, and emotional health. From memory foam mattresses to hybrids that keep you cool all night long, Lisa's mattresses offer exceptional comfort and support with free delivery and 100 nights to try out your mattress in the comfort of your home. For a limited time, save up to $700 off select mattresses plus two free pillows. Go to lisa.com/iHeart for an additional $50 off mattresses and select goods. Exclusions apply. See lisa.com for more details.